So today we're doing lesson 4 and a little bit of a recap of lesson 3. We looked at chapters 8 and 9 last week of the third canto. And in the ninth canto we discussed the Lord Brahma offering prayers to Garbhadaksha Vishnu, and we looked at some of the reasons why Lord Brahma was offering his obeisances to the Lord, the different aspects of the Lord that Lord Brahma was actually glorifying in his prayers. In essence, Brahma was glorifying the various transcendental qualities of the Lord. So we'll come back to chapter 9 in a little while, and we'll reflect on aspects of Lord Brahma's prayers which we may personally apply, different realizations that he has that we can actually take and apply in our devotional service. But before we do that, we're going to discuss a little bit from chapter 10 about the creations, the various creations of Lord Brahma. So at the end of chapter 9, Lord Brahma finishes offering his prayers, and after that the Lord Garbhadaksha Vishnu speaks in response to Brahma's prayers. We'll have a look at that, what he says, and we'll have a look at how he's basically pleased with Lord Brahma and gives Lord Brahma the assurance that he can now go ahead with the creation, because in essence the Lord empowers Brahma. He gives Brahma the ability to literally realize, perceive within how things should be within the creation, and then Lord Brahma, having a good understanding of how to organize things, how to utilize the various ingredients supplied by the Lord, how to distribute the seed forms of the creation to expand them to manifest the universe, the Lord assures Brahma that he will be able to do that. And that process begins in chapter 10. So just a little summary of chapter 10 and 11. We'll just look at chapter 10 first. Vidura, he inquires from Brahma. Vidura inquires from Maitreya how Brahma created the living beings and their various habitats. Maitreya replies that Brahma performed penance and then received inspiration and created the 14 divisions of planetary systems. So we're going to look at that. Vidura also inquires about eternal time. Some of the answers that Maitreya has given inspires Vidura to ask other questions that he may not have already asked, since they're relevant. And Maitreya describes, Vidura asks about eternal time, and Maitreya describes time as the impersonal feature of the Lord, and then describes the 10 different kinds of creations and three different types of destruction. So in essence, the Dura has asked many different questions about creation, and then he asks another question about time, how that fits in with the discussion of creation that Maitreya is going to give. So Maitreya literally summarizes creation in a simple way by describing how time influences creation, the 10 different types of creation, and 3 different types of annihilation. So in that way, he summarizes creation and annihilation in reference to time in a very simplified way to make the whole process of creation just very, putting it very simply. In chapter 11, of course, Maitreya then goes on to describe time in greater detail. We'll look at that later. So, Sutta Goswami, who of course is relaying this conversation of Maitreya to the Dura, goes on speaking to Shanaka Rishi. Shanaka Rishi, addressed by Sutta Goswami as the son of Bhrigu. Now, he begins that in verse 4 we see that Brahma engaged himself in penances for 100 celestial years as advised in the previous chapter by the Lord, and he applied himself in devotional service to the Lord. Lord Brahma sees that the lotus in which he is seated upon is trembling. The waters of the Gabadaka Ocean are also quite turbulent. Evidently because this is at the end of the period of devastation, the waters of the Gabadaka Ocean are still carrying some of that momentum, extra sort of power and force at this particular time. Now it describes that Lord Brahma in verse 6, that he drank the wind completely along with the water. And then in verse 7 describes that he saw that the lotus on which he was situated was spread throughout the universe. So, extending from Patala Loka up to Satya Loka. And he contemplated how to create all the planets which were previously merged in that very same lotus. So all the seeds, in essence, of the planets were in that lotus. Just like a scientist may look at his face and see that those seeds
something and they say, oh, this is the beginning of the creation of the sun. That's what they think it was. But they see this is the seed formation, this will form a sun. So, you know, Lord Brahma was able to see that the seed forms of the planets, for all the planetary systems, were there within the lotus. They're already generated by the Lord. We've discussed that previously in chapter 5 of the second chapter, I think it was. The Lord Brahma said that I am just creating with whatever what already has been created by the Lord, then I am doing the secondary creation. That's already been discussed in, when he was describing to Narada Muni that there is someone above himself, Krishna. The living entities were actually within Brahma. Keep in mind that Brahma has three forms. Vairaj Brahma is the form of Brahma who embodies the three planetary systems physically. Hiranyagarbha Brahma embodies all the living entities. And then there is four-headed Brahma who sits on Satyaloka. I will not play that. Brahma has three forms, three features. Vairaj Brahma, who embodies the three worlds physically. Hiranyagarbha Brahma, who embodies all the living entities, so they're within Brahma. And four-headed Brahma, who sits on the lotus. Sometimes it also refers to Gavadakshaya Vishnu, and sometimes it refers to, because it would depend upon which stage of creation you're talking about. So in other words, if you're referring to Gavadakshaya Vishnu as Hiranyagarbha, then all the living entities, including Brahma, reside within the Gavadakshaya Vishnu. At this stage, it's referring to Brahma because now all the living entities are residing within Brahma, including his own soul. It can refer to Kshiradakshaya Vishnu, it can refer to the, you know, because all of the living entities ultimately reside within the Virata Rupa, or the universal form. It can refer to the subtle form of the universal form. All the living entities are also contained within there. In essence, it refers to all the living entities within the universe, you know, who are sometimes referred to as being Gavadakshaya Vishnu, the universal form, or Brahma. So therefore, it's not wrong to call any of them Hiranyagarbha. And depending on from which aspect of creation we're looking at. Now, it's interesting, I mean, it's all interesting, this is less interesting. But sometimes you read different parameters, how, just like we see that, you know, Bhumi went to see Brahma before the appearance of Krishna. We know at that stage also Lord Brahma was actually sitting and hearing a recitation of music, and King Ravata appeared before him and in Satyaloka, and when King Ravata appeared before him, he said, oh, you know, all these different yugas have gone, Krishna and Balaram have just appeared. So the Acharyas say that actually Bhumi went to see Vairaj Brahma in Mount Meru, not the Brahma of Satyaloka. So sometimes it appears, you know, if you understand there are different features of Lord Brahma, then we can understand that sometimes the apparent differences in the Puranas and the what have you can be accommodated by understanding that things are a little bit more mysterious than what we may find first. So,
Brahma was able to perceive all these different elements and thought, yes, now I will create. Keep in mind the previous verse that, you know, he feels very confident, very much enlivened, enlightened as a result of the realizations and which have, come forth due to the blessings of the Lord and empowerment of the Lord to give him, you know, the realization, the understanding, the ability, the capability to now create. So he's feeling now he's confidently, you know, although somewhat disturbed there on the lotus flower, but he's just, you know, absorbed the wind and the water, which is a little turbulent that has somehow or another obscured his ability previously. Now he's able to see the lotus stem as much as he wants to in order to create, and he's confident to, you know, take these ingredients created by the Lord himself and begin creation. So, described in verse 8, Lord Brahma enters into the world of the lotus, and he divided into three divisions of worlds, and then into 14 divisions, thinking that that was, it needed to be further expanded to accommodate all the living entities that he needs to accommodate. This is a very so of course in summary, in answer to one of your homework questions, we've just discussed a brief description of Brahma's creation of the planetary systems from verses 4 to 9, and in essence we can understand that, you know, Lord Brahma sitting on top of that lotus in that scene with the wind and the lotus and the waters trembling, he has seen the ingredients of the seed forms of the planetary systems and the living entities, and he has begun to create first the three worlds and the 14 worlds. In essence, that's the summary of the answer to that question.
The drinking of the wind and water, that's not part of creation, because
it's a it is a preliminary description of the scene in which Lord Brahma is there. Yes, that's part of it. Now, the living entities are sometimes called pratibimbas. This is another one of the questions we need to focus upon, because it describes in the purport of verse number 9 that the conditioned souls in the material world they reflect part of the qualities of the Lord. The Lord is a reservoir of all qualities, and the living entities reflect part of the Lord's, and sometimes we call pratibimba, it means reflection. So the living entities inherit different proportions of his original qualities. And in terms of their inheritance of these qualities, they appear in different species of life. You know, that also is an answer to another question you quite often get. Why is there only 400,000 different species of life? Because they're, you know, reflecting so many different qualities of the Lord. Therefore we can understand the Lord's qualities. Many, many, many different qualities. And it's like we sometimes say that Chanaka Pandit, you know, you can learn one thing from a lion. What's the one thing you learn from a lion? Ferociousness. You can learn that from the junkyard dog. Now you can learn more from a lion. What you can learn from a lion, according to Chanaka Pandit, is that whatever you do, you do it with your whole heart and full energy. And you ever see a lion chase its prey? It's not tiptoeing along in a tutu. It's, you know, putting its whole effort into, you know, capturing that prey. It doesn't do anything by heart. So these all different species of life. You know, what can you learn from a crow? You can learn five things from a crow, or is it four? To be cautious, to put things aside for future use that may be useful. Not easy trusting other people. Keeping your family's affairs private. Not see like other birds, you don't see crows together. The other birds have seen them. You see crows, you just see. And if you've done all of those things, to be very bold. So, five things you can learn from the game. So, if you go through all the different species of life, you'll see that they're reflecting particular qualities. All of these qualities are actually reflections of the, you know, part of the reservoir of qualities of Krishna. Pratibimba. Now, just while we're in this part of the Bhagavad Gita, in verses 5 and 6, Srila Prabhupada brings a little something else out about Brahma's situation on the lotus, which was growing, and it was trembling due to strong violent wind. So the water and the lotus was trembling. So in the purport, he describes there is a declaration of war between the two parties. It means the demons and devotees. In essence, he summarizes it as a declaration of war between those engaged in the service of the Lord and the material energy creating illusion. So, and it describes, he says that the illusory energy and the devotee, sometimes the weak devotee falls victim to the onslaught of the powerful illusory energy. I see that may have happened to some of our students today. They've been waylaid. Sometimes the weak devotees fall victim to the onslaught of the powerful illusory energy. We see that, you know, that those devotees who got here today, they fought through the material energy, the wind, the rain, you know, all sorts of distractions, and somehow or another they all got here. Tiredness, fatigue, madness, everything. Now verse number 6, so we see that Lord Brahma was sufficiently strong by the causeless mercy of the Lord, and he could not be victimized by the material energy although it gave him cause for anxiety. And Prabhupada, in verse 6, he says, Lord Brahma's struggle for existence is a personal example of the continued fight between the living entities in the material world and the illusory energy called Maya. So this scene of Brahma on the lotus, struggling, you know, against a very disturbing situation, literally summarizes the plight of every living entity in the material world. But we can also see how Brahma deals with it, that such control of material energy can most successfully carry it out if one is a soul surrendered unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead and carries out his order in the spirit of loving transcendental service. So that's how we learn. Brahma was able to stand strong and be successful. So he was able to take control of the material energy being empowered by the Lord. Alright, so so Vidura asks that he asked Maitreya to tell him about time and the different symptoms of time and to describe them in detail, as we said. In detail will be described more in the next chapter. In this chapter we see that Maitreya describes eternal time is the source of the interactions of the three modes of material nature. It's unchangeable. Although it causes the interactions of the modes of material nature, it's not affected by the modes of material nature. So it doesn't become affected. It's limitless. So although it's creating time frames of, you know, there's the atom has a time frame, the ant's body, all living bodies have a time frame, the universe has a time frame. Although time is creating all the time frames, its time is limitless. And it works as the instrument of the Supreme Personality of Godhead for his pastimes in the material creation. Therefore, it's the impersonal form of the Lord. So we said, time is considered what? You might say, time is considered the impersonal feature of the Lord. Because, just like if someone holds a stick in their hand, the stick is the impersonal feature of the person. But it is an instrument which does the work of the person. So time is like that. It's a big stick. You can mix up the material energy, whack the living entities, you can do all sorts of things.
When you say that the Lord enters the Mahatattva as time?
Yeah.
But when you say that that is the energy of the Lord, and it is the source of the interaction between modes of material nature, we know that when Shiladrasa Vishnu glances,
yes,
that churning starts.
That's right.
So can you say that that glance is actually the injection of the time into the Mahatattva?
Yes, yeah. Yes, the Lord's glance the function of the Lord's glance is in fact carried out by time.
So you can't say the time energy of the Lord's glance?
Yes, the function of the Lord's glance is carried out by time, which is the energy of the Lord. So the Lord glances at the material energy, and the Lord's will is that the living entities shall be captured by the material energy, reformed, and given an opportunity for purification. That's the Lord's will. And the Lord's will is executed by his Shaktis, which combine in the form of time. At this stage, all the universes are within the Mahatattva, like a we see the Earth, planet, and the Moon. We're floating in space, and so similarly, all the universes, they're floating in Mahatattva, which is a very, very subtle element. Just like space, air is very, very subtle. Mahatattva is very, very subtle energy. So there is an actual energy there. It's very subtle, and all the universes are floating, they're actually within the Mahatattva.
There's
same
universes that have come out of the
portals
of
Karandaksha
and Vishnu.
Yep.
And they are in
Mahatattva
and
then. Yep. So those universes that have come from Mahavishnu have entered within the Mahatattva by the glance of Gavaraksha Vishnu. The ingredients of the Mahatattva combine to form the shell of the universe, and they also combine by the energy of Gavaraksha Vishnu to form the universal form within the universe, upon which Gavaraksha Vishnu enters along with his energies and the living entities, and takes that universal form within himself. It's in a very primeval stage, a fetal stage, if you say. It develops further within the Lord, then his abdomen, and later, the lotus flower comes. So, the Mahatattva is within and without, because everything is all the universes are within the Mahatattva, and at the same time, the ingredients of the covering of the universe and of the universal form itself is combined on the elements of the Mahatattva itself, in the same way that we may say that, we are situated within air, but the air is also situated within ourselves. So it's, the air is everywhere outside, but also our body is composed of the element air itself. So it's situated in a small portion within ourselves, and it's, wholeness outside
everywhere.
So when Lord Brahma is born, then he is, because it's said that he made a pure intelligence. So for his creation, another thing that is Mahatattva used. Lord Brahma, one of the features of Brahma, one of the forms of Brahma, comprises the whole three worlds in essence. Those three worlds are composed of the elements, the ingredients of the Mahatattva. Lord Brahma is described as the intelligence in the sense that the Supreme Lord is directly communicating with him through his heart, and therefore we see that the Lord reveals his form, gives him instructions, and so many things. So Lord Brahma's intelligence is directly connected with the Lord's personal communication, so it's not different from the Lord, because he's following a direct communion with Gavaraksha Vishnu. In fact, Lord Brahma's intelligence is coming from Gavaraksha Vishnu, therefore Gavaraksha Vishnu is Lord Brahma's intelligence. But he's, he is still, like all other living entities within, composed of the elements of the Mahatattva. Looking at time a little further, that this cosmic manifestation is separated from the Supreme Lord as material energy by means of time, by means of kala, which is the unmanifested impersonal feature of the Lord. So that, again, that's stated. Now Prabhupada says in verse 12, it is, or this cosmic manifestation is situated as the objective manifestation of the Lord under the influence of the same material energy of Vishnu. So, you know, taking from various statements in the purport, Prabhupada says that he quotes that Narada Muni spoke to the Asadeva in chapter 5, the first canto, verse 20, describing how this unmanifested world is the self same Supreme Personality of Godhead, but it appears to be something else beyond and or besides the Lord. It appears so because it is being separated from the Lord by means of kala. It is something like a tape recorded voice of a person who is now separated from the voice. Very nice description. Very nice example Prabhupada used. This is, of course, you know, an example of a modern acharya, because, you know, tape recordings are, you know, something that Prabhupada was dealing with, that other acharyas previously, although within nature, tape recorder, you know, is quite an interesting development. You can record sound and then your voice, and then you can say to your disciples, listen to that later. Whereas, you know, previously, you know, the acharyas would speak, and you know, if you didn't hear it, then you could hear it from someone else, but you may not hear the same sound of the voice from the acharya. So, you know, it's quite a significant thing. So you take that concept that you personally speak something, make some sound, so that's your personal action, and then you take that impersonal recording, which is no longer your personal self, but it still executes the same, it's now separated from you, and the impersonal energy will act in the same way as what the original person did. So time is like that. That it appears to separate the material creation from the Lord. The material creation ultimately is coming from the personal energy of the Lord. But time is able to take that personal energy and separately from the person manifest the material world. See the example? Yes. And by doing that, the interesting thing that Prabhupada points out is that therefore, having manifested, so in other words, we don't look around and see that, you know, when the sun comes up, you see a big hand of Garbhalakshya Vishnu attached to it and pushing it up in the sky. You know, he leaves it for there a bit, and then Garbhalakshya, you see him, and he moves it down, you know, like this. So then you see the Lord personally doing things. But what happens? His person is gone. He appears to be gone, but he is still doing it, but it's being done by his energy, his personal energy in the form of time. The time is now doing it. In the same way that a tape recorder, someone speaks, and then later the person goes away, and yet we still hear him speaking. See? So, and we think, well, you know, there's no person there. So therefore we don't look at a tape recording as the person, or as coming, you know, although in effect it is. So therefore, for most people, they feel therefore that the material creation is separate from the Lord, but time is giving it that appearance. Actually, it is always the personal energy of the Lord. Prabhupada says, this unmanifest world is, so we talk about the material energy, is the self-same personality of Godhead. It is Him. You know, this material world is God, because it's His energy, the energy being non-different from their source. And yet we look around, we say, oh, I don't see God. That's the influence of time. So it's a nice example. Meditate upon that one. Now, in the next verse, it describes the cosmic manifestation is as it is now. It was the same in the past, and it will continue the same way in the future. As Srila Prabhupada mentions, that the systematic activities of the time factor are perpetual and eternal and cannot be stated in false. Now, the reason this verse is presented here is because some people may say, alright, this universe appears to have, you know, and everything within it. I'm going to make this tape recorder. Keep forgetting to say over there. Can't go too far. This material world and everything in it appears to have a beginning and an end. And therefore, when things have a beginning and an end and they're gone, we say they're unreal. But this verse is saying that this cosmic manifestation eternally under this regime of time, you know, it describes this cosmic manifestation is as it is now. It was the same in the past and it will continue the same way in the future. So therefore that nullifies the impersonalists who want to say that the cosmic manifestation is unreal. So although time, so what happens, of course, time appears to make it look like there is no personality of Godhead involved and that things are acting separately. How are they acting separately? They're acting separately by the influence of time. But people see things acting and without any, you know, and they have a beginning and an end, and therefore the material manifestation must be unreal. But what we say is that if you look at the action of time, it is a eternally, perpetually manifesting the cosmic manifestation as we see it now. It has been like that since time immemorial, and it will always be that way. So it never really ceases to be. So, how would we summarize that information about time? From a devotee's perspective, we see that time is the energy of the Lord, which is, in effect, manifesting the material world by agitating the most mature nature and manifesting the material world in such a way that we can't see the personal creator. And therefore, most people without shastra would think that the material manifestation is an impersonal manifestation, which is unreal. And that's what time has done. Time has tricked everyone. Time tricks everyone to make it look like the material world is an impersonal manifestation of energy that's unreal. And that's the illusory nature of the material energy. So, time gives everything little time frames. So, you know, we see a little creature, and time gives it its time frame. 15 minutes, and it'll be dead. It comes and it goes, and therefore it appears that that living entity ultimately is has no permanent reality. That's the nature of time. That's the illusion that it's able to create with material energy. Any questions on that? It's quite it takes a lot of thought. Especially, depends how much gear you need to charge at lunchtime as well. How much of that's going to sink in? Yep. Because time in essence is influencing the material energy. It is agitating the modes of material nature to make different material manifestations. A devotee is not a material manifestation. A devotee is a spirit soul, and therefore the influence of time which is acting on the material manifestation does not affect the spirit soul. and at the same time, we've just discussed how time, its activities tend to facilitate the illusion that things are separate from the Lord and unreal. Times, but a devotee understands that's the energy of the Lord. Its function is to create that, you know, illusion that everything is separate from the Lord and unreal. But the devotee's knowing, you know, when we study the Bhagavad Gita, there are five topics. We study time, material nature, the living entity, karma, Ishvara, and we understand that all of those different features of the Lord eternally associated with Him. So, therefore, the devotee isn't affected by the illusory aspect of time, and the devotee is not affected by the material aspect of time upon its material body, because the devotee is on the platform of the soul. So in both ways. So physically, mentally, intellectually, philosophically, on any level, the effect the time is having on others is not affecting the devotee. Although time affects the material body, the devotee is not associating himself with the material body, and at the same time, the time energy in effect assists the devotees. So all of the energies of the Lord, ultimately when one becomes fixed up in the service of the Lord, time, material energy, the various features of the material energy, they all assist the devotee in their service to the Lord. It's not impeding. So that's another way in which time does not act on devotees in the same way that it acts on materials. And therefore you see, in the Krishna book, it describes that when different personalities go to Vrindavan, or the places where Krishna is residing, they see that even the very elderly people are running around very youthfully, as if time hasn't affected them, because they're so enthusiastic in the service, and the time element is actually maintaining their youthfulness even in old age. You see that. So in those ways also. We see that with Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada was a very active grandfatherly figure, in his 80s, and still keeping a pace that his young, 20 to 30 years old, big, strong bodied disciples could not keep up with him. His energy and his enthusiasm. He had the energy and the enthusiasm of many of his disciples combined. They could not compete. Alright. Now, then we get to look at the cosmic manifestation . He describes that in verse 14 there are 9 different kinds of creations beside the one which naturally occurs due to the interaction of the modes, and there are 3 kinds of annihilations due to eternal time. The material elements, according to eternal time, the material elements and the quality of one's work. So, here, Maitreya has been asked about time, and in order to discuss time in the next chapter, he will discuss it in more detail. Here he's going to discuss time by describing its 10 different types of creations which are manifested through time, and 3 different types of destruction. So in verses 14 to 29, we get the 9 creations. We can flip the dice. I don't know who's going to want to start work here.
Duruni,
yeah. This is one of our younger devotees' interpretation of creation.
like a hungry horse or an apple tree. In this verse, it describes that there are 10 creations. 9 different kinds of creation plus one which naturally occurs due to the interactions of the modes. Srila Prabhupada mentions in his purport the three types of annihilation, which we'll have a look at in a minute. Now in summary, there are 6 types of creation called Prakriti. P-R-A-K-R-T-A. 6 types of creation called Prakriti. Number 1, Mahatattva. Number 2, false ego. Number 3, sense perception and the corresponding elements. Number 4, the knowledge and working senses. Number 5, the controlling deities. And number 6, it's called Tamasa Saga, or the creation of the covering of ignorance. The 5th is the controlling deities. Now, there are 4 types which we can put under the heading notes from the. There's movable entities. These are called Vaikrita. V-A-I-K-R-T-A. Vaikrita. Immovable entities. Then 28 lower species. That's the next one, number 8. And number 9 is humans.
What does number 10 mean?
Immovable living entities. Alright. Now, number 10.
What
does
number
10?
Humans.
Humans. It's the last one.
And then
4th
is...
The 10th one is demigods, of which there are 8 different types. Now...
Kid?
What's that?
What's
the
number
8
and 9 over there?
The second is 8, 9, 10. 28 lower species. 28
lower species.
And then humans.
Like
7, 4
is
the types of creation.
Yeah.
And then Vaikrita.
Yeah,
that's right. Now, this 10th one, we've got it in this list here, but it's the one that, when in Srila Prabhupada's translation, he says, and besides the one which naturally occurs due to the interactions of the modes. He appears to be speaking to that 10th one because, for instance, Vishnu Chakrabarti Kaur says that the 10th type is a combination of material creation and Brahma's creation. And then he, in his commentary, describes that that is the creation of the deities. So it's these first 6 are elemental in the sense that they're creations of the Lord. Right? And these 3 are creations of Brahma.
whereas the demigods are considered elemental and creations of Brahma. Creations of the Lord and Brahma. That combination produces the demigods.
You said the elemental ones were prayed during the...
Yes, that's right. Yes. Some of the demigods, as we saw, actually, even before Brahma was born, those elemental demigods were creations of Mahavishnu, and Brahma had nothing to do with them. And then later, Brahma creates other, and we see that some of the demigods also form within the form of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, when the universal form is in that fetal state, becoming more and more distinct in its features.
Can you buy a big
video?
Because it's actually hard to read.
I was going to fast, so I couldn't make it bigger.
Can you read it loud from
a big video? Which one is
it? Can you read it loud from or just take it down? Mahatattva, false ego, how's that?
Sense perception, knowledge and working senses, controlling deities,
knowledge and working
senses, then five, controlling deities. Six is covering of ignorance.
And six is what too?
Covering of ignorance.
Covering of?
Ignorance.
Created by Brahma, except for some of the elemental demigods that were there even before Brahma.
Do you mean their bodies and their sattva?
Yes, the gross and sattva bodies. So then, let's look at the three different kinds of destruction that were mentioned. Now, so everyone's got that, jot it down. If you like, I have a page here. I will have to go at about 4:30 or so, but I'll leave you this to photocopy.
Yeah.
It has the essential items for chapter 10 and for chapter 11, the breakdown of time and what have you. So if you do...
I need the key.
Yeah, at least 15, because others will come later.
Because it's got all of that on it.
It's all there, yeah.
Oh,
interesting. So you don't have to write down. At least you can do 23 if you can. All right. But I just wanted it up there so that as we go through them, you can just focus on them if you haven't got this. That's it. All right. Three different types of destruction also mentioned. Now,
just one second, Prabhu.
Yeah.
If you could tell what is the sense perception?
We're going to come to each one. All right. So now we'll just, as long as you've got the heading, and then we'll look at each different type individually. The first destruction, due to the scheduled time of the annihilation of the entire universe, as Srila Prabhupada puts it. In essence, it is a destruction due to kala or eternal time. You know that we're talking about the destruction at the end of Brahma's life, which means that, you know, the destruction of all the universes. Gradually all, you know, when Brahma's life ends, you know, it means that Lord Vishnu, Mahavishnu is breathing in all the universes and all the Brahmas. They're all coming to the end of life, all the universes. So that is due to eternal time kala, that destruction.
Even the night of Brahma, that also.
No.
So that's also time.
The night of Brahma is not this first due to the scheduled time of the annihilation of the entire universe. No. Yeah. It's more this next one, which is. It's under the heading of Dravya, you know, where the material elements, the fire emanates from the mouth of Ananta or Sankishan and destroys the various elements which combine to form the three worlds.
That's the second one.
That's the second one. Yeah. As Prabhupada puts it, it's due to the fire emanating from Ananta. It is the destruction at the end of Brahma's day. And the third one is due to one's qualitative actions and reactions. It's, you know, gunai, karma and guna, in essence. The various individual bodies are destroyed. You know, every living entity is destroyed, their bodies. Their actions bring about the karma.
Due to one's qualities?
It's due to one's qualities, the material qualities, and the reaction of the modes of material nature. You know, destroying the body.
In the first type of destruction, isn't it that there is a liar in there?
What's that?
In the first destruction for liar, is the inundation. At the end of Brahma's life?
At the end of Brahma's life, yes.
There's the water inundation.
I'm just not sure what you mean by liar. At the end, you know, this first one is when Mahavishnu breathes in.
Oh, yeah, breathes in.
Whereas the second one is at the end of Brahma's day.
So there is a fire comes and there is a water, no water in that
destruction? Yes, there is.
Oh, okay.
Now, there are. Usually, when you see information about that destruction at the end of Brahma's day, mm-hmm. We quite often just get a part of the picture. But there are variations. In essence, it is described here. We will get to it in the next chapter. But Ananta, at the bottom of the universe, the fire emanates from him. It destroys the three worlds. The residents from Mahaloka, etc., go up. And they go to Brahma Loka. All the three worlds are destroyed. There's a fire and then water, so it's all submerged, broken down, and all those living entities who are destroyed, the one with all the elements, are actually enter within Gavarakshai Vishnu. And. Now, evidently, at the end of the first half of Brahma's life, at that stage, Lord Brahma and all those residents on Brahma's planet
also enter within Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. And hence we have different scenarios. You know, this sort of partly answers your question, Nimala, about does Brahma do the same thing? In essence, there is a partial creation of the three worlds, but as we said last week, the lotus flower does not always form. It forms in the Padma Kalpa. So we hear generally descriptions in the Bhagavatam about the first day of Brahma. We hear descriptions about the last day of the first half of Brahma's day, and we hear descriptions about the first day of the second half of Brahma's life. So the residents of Brahma Loka, all the ones that come from, you know, Mahaloka, Tapaloka, Janaloka, they all go to Brahma Loka and they reside there while the three worlds are destroyed, but not their planetary system, although because of the heat and what have you, they do go to Brahma Loka where it's actually better. And they pray to the Lord while during the night of Brahma. Some of them pray to the Lord and they rest and what have you. Then the three worlds are created again. But at the end of the half of Brahma's life, Brahma and all those demigods from Satyaloka, they all enter within the form of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, and therefore in the next day the creation is more extensive, because the devastation was more extensive. So therefore there are slight differences in what Brahma does. So in some cases when Brahma appears, you know, there's total no other living soul around, and in other cases it is not exactly the cut in that case. So there are variations. That varies. That sometimes during Brahma's day, Brahma goes to sleep. Which is, you know, he doesn't always do that, but sometimes he does, and there can be a partial annihilation then. Sometimes, during the change of Manus, there can also be a partial annihilation. We'll look at all these, but in essence, there are variations. So, this second one has a lot of subcategories. We don't have to go into it now. We will come through them even in this chapter. In the next chapter, we'll discuss that at more length. I've just given you a little bit of a preview.
When there is a devastation, it can continue.
Sorry?
Why there is a devastation? Why there is annihilation? Everything has to be, destroyed in the heat phases.
Yes.
It's my
answer, because time has given everything its set time frame. So therefore, when its time frame is finished, it is destroyed. So everything within the universe has been given a time frame, so it must be destroyed. It must be known. And that's the difference between material life and eternal life. There is no destruction, no creation. Material life means a constant cycle of creation, maintenance, and destruction. Time, therefore, everything is destroyed and must be recreated. But in spiritual existence, that is not there.
So the time is not there in the spiritual world.
No, time is conspicuous by its absence.
From some Jesus point of view, like in the living entities, they are anyway they are defined by their body.
Yes.
So when their body gets destroyed, they think for them that's the end anyway. So what is the significance of this partial annihilation and complete annihilation for the living entity?
Yeah. Well, it means that, for instance, we understand gradually as a person actually becomes intelligent. We saw that in the previous chapter that the intelligent ones, the Paramahamsas, they understand that this material world is a place of suffering, and therefore they take their enjoyment and satisfaction on the spiritual platform. Those who are grossly foolish or animalistic, they don't know that they're suffering, and therefore they ignore it even though they're suffering. The ones who, the rest, which is the humans, they gradually understand that they are suffering and that they have no real happiness, and that if they want happiness, they have to again go towards the spiritual energy, take shelter of the spiritual energy. So, just like we may think, oh, I'll only live for 50 years. Yeah, I'm better off to become a devotee and go back to Godhead and live for eternity. So, knowing that we have a certain lifespan, it helps us to, it pushes us towards again taking shelter of the eternal realm. But then one might think, I'll just go and become a Brahma and I'll, live on Brahma Loka or the heavenly planets. And then we understand, well, there's no value there either, because you go there and it's the same cycle of creation and destruction, even if you live as the longest living creature within the universe, which is trillions and trillions and trillions of years. You still must die, and therefore there's twofold effect. One, that you can't escape death even if you're the most pious person in the universe and the most exalted and intelligent and most powerful person in the universe, you still must be destroyed. So there's the example there. And at the same time, if we're so foolish to think, oh, I really am happy, then you can't stay anyway. If someone thinks, oh, I'm really happy and oh, I'm getting really attached, I don't care if you think it's suffering. Okay, you'll be attached, but it's all going to be taken off you anyway. So, so either way, time is pushing us towards taking shelter of the spiritual energy. Which is good for us, because that's the actual platform of happiness. Because our happiness in this world is actually suffering and illusory. Alright, so let's look at the different creations one by one, just quickly. The first one is the creation of the Mahatattva. Alright? Where the interaction of the modes interact. You all got one? Oh, good. Okay. Good. Now, the first one, creation, as we discussed, the Mahatattva. It's a creation of the sum total of material ingredients, as Srila Prabhupada says. It's the first emanation. The second of the nine creations, so remember there's one which is in between those, so we're talking about the other nine, which is not the tenth one. So the first nine, the second is the false ego, ahankara. Now we'll see in successive creations that the various material ingredients, material knowledge, material activities will arise.
suppose we're just talking about the creation of the city of Hungary.
First is the creation of the Haktopa, which is the subtle form of the sum total of all material ingredients, and then there's the creation of the Mahatattva, which is the false ego. So it is a feature of the Mahatattva where it acts in such a way to bind the living entities by influencing them to identify themselves with the Mahatattva, the elements of the Mahatattva as
is that the outermost covering of the universe for Parsi?
Yes. Now, in the third creation, so it's the senses. The sense perceptions. And from these, the elements. We're talking about the tongue matras, the subtle senses, from which the gross elements manifest. Alright? Bhuta sagas and dravya, sometimes. Or tongue matras. The fourth is the creation of knowledge and working capacity, as Srila Prabhupada states. Basically, it's the creation of the senses, which consists of the knowledge senses and the action senses. That's what that means. Right? And
The sense object comes under the sense perception.
Yeah, the third one. Now, in the fifth creation, that of the controlling deities by the interaction of the mode of goodness, of which the mind is the sum total. So, you know, we know that the ahankara, the sattva portion of ahankara, creates the presiding deities over the senses in the mind. The sixth creation is the ignorant darkness of the living entity by which the master acts as a fool to the purpose. So this is the creation of ignorance. This is a manifestation of avidya shakti, or Maya has three features. This avidya shakti of Maya bewilders a buddhi, the living entity.
What is covering of ignorance?
Yes.
That's the default, is it, for every living entity?
Yes.
They have to be covered.
Yes. Not so much the demigods.
For the passion.
Because they're more in sattva. It says to some degree, but not it's much slighter than others. But anyone who's under the influence of material energy will be influenced by the avidya sakti to some degree, either to a great degree or a lesser degree. Prabhupada mentions in his purport to that verse about the demigods and the asuras, the devas are situated in mode of goodness, the asuras are situated in passion and ignorance. After the creation of the demigods, all entities are covered by darkness of ignorance.
it bewilders them. But the devotee to the Lord engaged in pure devotional service, this energy becomes vidya, or pure knowledge. It describes here the energy of the Lord transforms from Mahamaya to Yogamaya and appears to pure devotees in her real feature. So that's what we were describing before to Bhakti Sara, how the energies of the Lord in fact act in the service of the devotees more so as more than obstacles. And the Prabhupada saying that the Mahamaya transforms to Yogamaya, its original form, and appears to the devotee in her real feature, not the illusory feature. The material nature therefore appears to function in three phases: as the creative principle. So the material energy has these three: it creates, it covers with ignorance, or it produces knowledge, material knowledge. Now, the feature of avidya, Prabhupada mentions, has five different influences: attachment, hatred, pride, ignorance, and false identification. That's mentioned down below. But we'll look at them later, but just to let you know, they are five different features, specific features of avidya. So in essence, you know, Maya produces the Pradhan, which is a real creation. But in her features as Vidya and Avidya, she bewilders the living entity with five different types of ignorance. That's not real. The vidya knowledge destroys the five types of ignorance. So the material energy is acting in these three ways. Yeah, the material energy is acting to actually create material elements which are real. They create the bodies, and then the material nature acts in such a way as to bewilder the living entities, so that they want to enjoy that which is actually suffering. They act very foolishly, but the material energy can also award material knowledge by which one can see what one can actually become free from the bewildering feature of Maya. So they're all functions of the material energy: vidya, avidya, and the pradhana. So, that is being described there, that that's creation. Now, these are all natural creations by the external energy of the Lord. All that we've described there so far, we've described six different types of creations, all generated from Maya Shakti. Therefore, they're creations by the Lord, by His energy. They're called Prakriti. Now, the secondary creations, or Vaikritam, come from Brahma, His intelligence. He takes these ingredients and then He creates. So, now
can you do a little bit more on controlling the
this one? A little bit more?
Yeah.
The names and addresses? The controlling deities of the senses and the mind.
So they're conscious
entities? They're conscious entities, yes.
They're demigods?
They're demigods. very crucial demigods, because they in fact preside over, control the working centers, knowledge gathering centers, and the functions of the mind of all living entities in the material world. That is what is actually described as a manifestation of, we saw that even before Brahma is born, that, they are manifested, within the Mahatattva. And we saw that, it was the various elements, including the demigods, that preside over the elements, so the elemental deities and the presiding deities of the senses, they all originally prayed to the Lord before he entered his Garbhadaksha Vishnu. So therefore, they're all creations of the Lord by his energy, before Brahma even takes birth. And other demigods come later. We see that the seventh is immovable entities of six different kinds. Well, it will tell us. It tells us exactly what they are. Immovable entities. These are immovable.
Mountains.
More like flora and fauna. There may be some. Anything which is not mentioned but is in the immovable list will be here, and therefore, yes, some mountains they're sort of rare categories of immovable entities, so you would put them in this list, because they don't fit into the other list. And the same with each of the categories. They're given a category, and generally, where they a living entity most suitably fits, you put them into that category. So here it's describing, we have plants without flowers but that have fruits. You've got annual plants that perish after a year. Plants that need support to rise up. You can see Srila Prabhupada's translation, and I'm just reading a commentary of one of their charis just clarifies his statements a little bit as well. So we've got, from the beginning, plants without flowers but they have fruit. Annual plants perishing after a year. Plants that need support to rise up. Then you've got bamboo and other hollow plants. Plants which do not depend upon support to rise. The trunk is stiff. And those which give fruit through flowers. Now, they seek their sustenance upwards. As they become nourished, they sort of grow up. They're almost unconscious, but have feelings of pain within. There you go, Shastra, they do feel pain. They're manifested in variegatedness. In other words, their dimensions are not particularly fixed. There's unlimited variety. Now, the eighth creation, the lower species of life, and they are 28 varieties. Now, they're very foolish and ignorant. They know their desirables by smell, but are unable to remember anything within the heart. So, they don't tend to grow up, but sort of grow horizontally, in one sense. They've got no concept of the future. That's when it says they are unable to remember. It means that they've got no concept of the future. They're preoccupied with now, you know, food, sleep, mate. So they're preoccupied totally with that. So they're not thinking, you know, like in a couple of days, you know, I'll do this. Even if, you know, they, like we see them hibernate or store nuts in their little burrows and things, you know, they're still, out of natural instinct, they're just, you know, thinking of now, in essence, and, you know, just acting, you know, by instinct. They're not really, you know, planning ahead. It may seem like that, but they're still just acting out of instinct for now. You know, otherwise the squirrel might think, you know, instead of every year I put a stock of nuts in my burrow to last me through winter, you know, what I'm going to do is just plant a couple of these around my little burrow and, you know, just have a constant supply so that, you know, whatever. They don't think in such terms, you know, or, you know, maybe I'll move my burrow and I'll just live next to the grocery store then. You know, they don't plan out things like that. They're just acting according to now, you know, even if it appears that they're planning. So, they're basically just aware of the eating and sleeping habits. Now, there's lower animals like cows, goats, buffalo, the Krishna stag, the hog, the gavaya animal, the deer, the lamb, the camel. They all have two hooves. Then you have one hoofed animals. Horse, mule, ass, etc. Like that. And the donkeys.
The main one too.
They don't have cloven hooves. The first group was cloven hooves, or you call them two hooves, or cloven hooves they call them.
Cows.
Yeah, like cows. You know, it's more like one continuous hoof. But, you know, others, they had cloven hooves. No, the camels and that, they had cloven hooves, which means that there's a separation, right?
Yeah, division.
Division. There's a division. Cloven hooves means there's divisions within the hooves. And then when we say one hoof, means that their hoof is just you know, one continuous hoof without division. Okay. So then you have those which have five nails, you know, or five claws, what have you. So you've got the dog, the jackal, the tiger, the fox, rabbit, etc., monkeys, elephants, tortoise. So, you know, the elephants have five toenails. Although it looks like one big foot, but, you know, it's obviously the same distinction. Now, amongst them, you've got the... it describes, well, you've got a gosapa, there's alligators, etc. Means that they're called makaras, or various types of aquatics as well, with five nails. Some aquatics have five nails. Then then you have the heron, vulture, crane, hawk, etc., which are birds. You know, some of these are aquatic birds, some are land dwelling birds. As Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur points out, all fishes are classed as just one group. You know, other animals,
somehow fall within these various classes. So, you know, there Maitreya Muni has just he's not doing a biological class, he's just giving, you know, some essential understanding how to quickly group the various, in essence we understand all the various animals, fish, birds and everything. They'll all fit into some of those categories. The ninth creation is the human beings. You know, we can just take them all as one species, although there may be 400,000 different varieties, you know, and then 400,000 different varieties of, you know, living entities, of which 400,000 different species of humans, but here we're just saying, we just take all of them as still one species with 400,000 different sub-varieties, you know, you can say, of humans, right? And it describes a little bit about, so, what was that? 400,000 different species. Where are they? Yeah, that's the question. Well, I've seen several statements by Srila Prabhupada where people say, oh, so that includes the demigods. Prabhupada say, no, they're all here. You know, I've seen several statements like that. Because here we see the demigods classified differently. And yet some, you know, some devotees say that, you know, it includes all the human formed demigods in the higher planets. So it's a big topic, but you know, Prabhupada quite often refers to this reference, you know, that there are human beings, that is one fruit. But which, you know, we know later that there are 400,000 species according to the Purans. And then there's demigods, which are actually a different species. And Prabhupada quite often answers that question in this way. They say, oh, you know, does that include all the demigods? He says, no, here. Although sometimes I have seen that he does generally include them, you know, all as having human form once.
Is that
according
to consciousness, or is that according to the
type? Well, it's according to their type of body and their consciousness, because here it does describe that they have a predominance of rajas, and they're dedicated to work, and they think themselves happy even in distress.
Yeah.
So their consciousness is somewhat different to the demigods, and they work harder than what demigods like to do.
And that is in one universe, or
no? We're talking about in this universe, and each universe, you know, this division is as described in previous verse. You know, this is this, you know, a standard for creation.
It may also include living entities in the sun, planet,
and some of them. Yes, amongst demigods. Yeah. There are demigods, and then there may be, you know, even within, you know, throughout the universe, there's sort of those which are, you know, somewhere in between. You know, are they demigod, or are they sort of, you know, more human? Something else. So, you know, we're doing a very broad category here. So sometimes, you know, as we see with Srila Prabhupada, it depends on the context of what people want to know and what they need to understand as to how you answer the question. You know, you may answer someone's question in this very broad way. The definite distinction between humans and demigods, and then you may answer that question in a, you know, that there are a lot of, say, crossovers and overlapping. If people need to understand the variety of the Lord, what have you.
Yeah.
Yes, because he's giving just a very broad description, broad enough literally that anything which is not mentioned is either which should fit into one of these different categories, or you know, the subcategories, or there may be some slight intermingling of the categories, but he's not concerned with that level of detail. Because you know, his main focus here is to distinguish. if we get into the discussion of the different species of life, we lose the focus on. Here, Maitreya, at the point of the Bhagavatam and the knowledge and the questions that is being asked by Vidura, we are getting a lesson in the, you know, we've heard all about the Saga creation, and now we're getting a lesson in what Brahma creates. So, in a very broad category way, he is describing all of creation, everything. You know, we see so much information we've covered. In a couple of statements, he's going to categorize all of the primary creation of Saga in just six groups, you know, very quickly. And then everything that Brahma does, he's going to categorize into three, and then there's just one, you know, slide in between. So he's just making it very simple so that we can initially see the distinction. Oh, yes, this is what Brahma does. And Brahma doesn't do any of that. The material energy acted, you know, doing that from Mahavishnu and did all of that, and Brahma does this, and then, you know, with that understanding there, then later he will go into more detail where required. And the various Puranas also go into slightly more detail. you know, it's like saying if 50 guests turn up and they're all elderly, you know, a bus of elderly people pull up and we say, oh, we need 50 chairs and some scones and LT. But if we say that, oh, there's 50 chairs in here, now some of them may be stools and some of them may be chairs, but if I say, quick, go and get the 50 seats in, you know, the theatre and take them upstairs. And then they come back and say, well, you know, younger, some of them are chairs and some of them are stools, some of them are sort of like footstools, you know, what do you want? You know, my basic point is get 50 seats up there, you know, really quickly. So, it's like that. You know, now, if I wanted for some other specific purpose, I said, I'm doing a wedding, I want you to go and get the two nice looking chairs, you know, that may have gone into the theatre room, they're made out of wood, you know, so then for a specific purpose I may separate them like that. So for his purpose he's just describing, so and he just wants to get across the point what Brahma created and what you know, Krishna's material energy created. Now he describes that the last three creations and the creations of the demigods, which is the tenth creation, are Vaikrita creations, which are different from the previously described Vaikrita natural condition creations.
here it describes the appearance of the Kumaras as both. So we see that, you know, the tenth creation is in effect the creation of the demigods, but we have to consider that the creation of the demigods, that Brahma creates all the other demigods that were not created by Krishna's material energy in the first primary creation.
Demigods like Ganesh and Durga, they are all commanders. Vaikuntha?
Well, you know, those that are primary controlling deities, you know, the Prakriti, primary controlling deities. You know, you see that on, for instance, the heavenly planets, you know, there are primary deities like Indra and this one and that one, and then he has so many servants and people who, you know, run messages and, you know, like this. So, you know, they're creations of Brahma, the others. And those primary, you know, if they weren't created by Sattva Guna, Ahankara, with the portion of Sattva Guna, then they're creations of Brahma later. And the ones that are created by Brahma later are mentioned. We'll go through them and it'll tell us. But we should understand in the beginning that Kumaras are considered both. So in other words, we can say that they appeared as predominating deities, you know, when the Hankara was manifesting the various predominating deities of the senses and the elements and what have you. And later they also appeared from Brahma. What's that? All right, so we're pretty much on our last one verse. Okay, the creation of the demigods is of eight varieties. The demigods, the forefathers, the Asuras or demigod or demons, sorry, the Gandharvas and Apsaras or angels. So we're up to four. All right, so the demigods is one. Forefathers is the second category. Third category is the Asuras or demons. Fourth category is the Gandharvas and Apsaras or angels. Fifth, Yakshasas and Rakshasas. Sixth, Siddhas, Charanas and Vidyaharas. See, they're singers, dancers, you know, like that. Seven, Bhutas, Pratas and Pisachas. I still sound stupid. Yeah, all of them. And eight, the superhuman beings, celestial singers, etc., are all created by Brahma, the creator of the universe. Some words are just captured here. Every time I say it, I say it differently. I said it before. So I'm going to stop. Alright. These eight types of beings in the daily creation of Brahma. See all those ones listed there? They're not the presiding deities of the various elements and senses, what have you. There is a different category, the creations of Brahma. Alright, and
that concludes chapter 10. So next week, if you read all of chapter 11 and all of chapter 12, it will be our last lesson. Any other questions that you may have from chapter 9, I will discuss a little bit. And perhaps the following week, so next week, today, did we pass our list around to sign that? We probably didn't. With Kadama Kanana? I did speak to Atulia, who was organising, and told her that, you know, I'm basically finishing up within a couple of weeks, and I was hoping that she'd organise it, that it didn't coincide with our class.
I think that's what she did.
And she said she'd organise that. So, you know, Kadamba Kanana's seminar will be inside, as far as I understand. Because basically we'll have one more lesson, which is, what is next week? That'll be about the 9th. The following week, would be about the 16th, 17th, something like that. What's that?
15th.
No, that's, yeah, 15th. That's in. The following week, we will have, so next week's, what day is that?
8th.
Our final lesson.
Yeah.
The following week is 15th.
The
no. We will have a revision. And then possibly the exam even. And what's the following week? That's Diwali. Let's go with food or something?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Was that
yeah.
Like
last 3 days
of
the month.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
On the 22nd, Chandrasekhar is going to do a slideshow for us describing the creation and the scientific understanding of creation, so that when we're speaking to people who have a scientific understanding of creation, that we understand what they're thinking when we're presenting the Srimad Bhagavatam, and how we can, you know, speak our understanding, you know, knowing what they're thinking like that, right? So that's on the 22nd, don't miss that. So before then, the week before then, will be an exam, and yeah, so that'll be on the 15th. No, it's all finished. On the 22nd, basically, that's the last day we do Chandrasekhar's thing. We're finished for the year. So on the 15th, we're going to do an exam, and that means that, you know, at the start of that day, at 2 o'clock, I will do a revision. And, you know, the discussion for, you know, a couple of hours, anything you want to ask me that you're not sure of, and then we'll do the test in the last part of that. And then, you know, so next week is our last lesson. We finish up to chapter 12, and then so, you know, by the 22nd, we're finished for the year, and we'll come back next year sometime in February.
Next time, is it the writing or multiple choice?
Yeah, no, just as we always do. What it does, anyone who has essays, of course, it gives them time between now and next February to get other things in. If they miss exams, they want to get that in. People, of course, can finish off their Bhakti Shastri and everything like that. So, you know, we're going to finish early, but a lot of people need, otherwise it gets a bit intense for people. Alright, so 22nd is our last day. Read everything you can up to chapter 12, and that will be the end of it.
So that the aspect of Brahman prayer, which we can apply, that we're going to be doing next
week. We're going to do that next week. Bit of chapter 9, chapter 11, it's a very short chapter, and chapter 12.